Okay, so good morning and welcome back. Good to see you and welcome to those of you who are new. If you weren't here yesterday, you don't have to feel like you're actually coming here in the middle. But today we're continuing with the same theme, but we're actually starting with a different discourse. And that's what we've been doing this weekend, is actually just reflecting on a few of the early discourses that the Buddha offered around this theme of both befriending the mind, but knowing that befriending of the mind really rests upon understanding the mind that we live with and live through. Just a reminder that the day is in silence, so if we could just be careful with that in the building, in the parking lot. And we'll also do some practice, and maybe even a little bit more practice today than yesterday. What we left off with yesterday was some exploration of the sort of many dimensions of skillful effort that we bring to training the mind. And yesterday I was really encouraging everyone to please assimilate this idea of training the mind. You know, the mind doesn't show up volunteering to be calm and still and clear. This is actually an outcome of the efforts and the intentions that we bring and how we incline the mind towards that which is lovely and liberating and helpful, rather than the mind being so much entangled in its own habits that don't serve us well. So we ended up yesterday just speaking about, you know, the multi layers of effort that we bring, that effort is not just about striving or forcing. There's something creative, experimental about how we approach some of the most intractable and stubborn patterns that we live with and experience. And, you know, these are very universal patterns, although we do tend to take them very personally. You know, the untrained mind is really pretty prone to obsess, particularly. To obsess, to become preoccupied, to proliferate, to ruminate. And we experience it, although we're sometimes quite engaged with that proliferation, we often feel it to be a kind of psychological vandalism. You know, clutters up the space. So beginning to befriend the mind always has its starting point, its embarkation point in our capacity to be mindful of what is going on. It's interesting, mindfulness is of the many lists in the Buddhist teaching. You know, mindfulness often occupies the first place in those lists because it is the starting point for everything, isn't it? That we start to be awake to what is actually going on. We start to be curious. We start to look a little bit more closely. And to actually have that, be able to turn mindfulness towards the mind, not necessarily so involved in the contents, but in the process of minding, the process of minding. And in the discourse we were looking at yesterday, you know, mindfulness is a beginning point, and then we do bring some investigation, you know, just those simple questions of what's actually going on here. You know, how is it changing? This is a really big one. To really have that sense of arising and passing within the mind, within the thoughts, within the moods, within the mind states, how that is changing and what it is that sort of interrupts or freezes that changing process. And we often see that what actually really freezes that changing process is the tendency to take hold and the tendency to contract and the tendency to identify and cling. So we begin to investigate. You know, this is arising, this is passing. Investigation takes us to understanding some of the themes that we return to. Interesting, the Buddha often spoke about, one way he spoke about liberation was the freedom from indebtedness. Freedom from indebtedness. You know, and clearly he wasn't talking about financial debt, but he did use that metaphor. He said, you know, to consider what it feels like to be in debt, you know, how that weighs on your mind, you know, how it creates anxiety, about how it creates rumination, you know, that sense of being bound. And then he says, imagine what it's like to be actually able to repay that debt and to be free of that debt. And the sense of relief and the sense of space that would come. But when he spoke, applied that inwardly, you know, he said, what we are indebted to, again, we are bound to. And we worry about and we fret over and we become vexed by. And it often becomes clear to us what we are indebted to, because this is what we keep returning to in the mind. This is what keeps the mind sort of stuck in that vexation. So he said to investigate, begin to look at these themes, you know, be aware of where we are indebted and what it would take, what would be asked of us to actually put down that debt. You know, and he used this refrain, as I mentioned yesterday in this discourse, and if it still arises. And he wasn't saying, you know, there's two ways of saying that, isn't there? It's still arising. You know, that sense of kind of hopelessness and despair and, you know, oh, not again, you know. Or it's actually saying, uh-huh, this is where we're really tightly tied up and tangled, you know. It still arises. It says, well, experiment with taking your attention elsewhere, you know, to something that's not involved in that contractedness. It might be so simple as taking the attention to the body or taking the attention to listening. It might be actually taking our attention to a different cultivation of metta or compassion. Take our attention elsewhere. Cultivate what's missing, you know, and what is really missing in contractedness? It's a sense of spaciousness, isn't it? A sense of easefulness. And spaciousness, again, is not an outcome of struggle. It, again, it's a quality of mind that is very much cultivated. You know, it's interesting how nature is a great ally, I think, in cultivating spaciousness. You know, to actually, you know, I look out the window and, you know, how easily my eyes are just drawn to the trees or the buildings, or to look at the space around the trees. Look at the space around the buildings, you know, to begin actually to cultivate that sense of widening the field of our awareness. She talks about having the resolve not to keep dwelling, not to bring our attention into those places that don't serve us well, if they're dried out old habits, you know, they're kind of dried out old habits. And there's another discourse which offers something else, which I didn't include in the list yesterday. It says, if it still arises, ask for help. Ask for help. So we explore, you know, as we sit and as we practice today, we begin to again really bring that curiosity to the question of what it means to befriend the mind, or what it means to cultivate a mind of friendliness, a mind that's not bound in ill will or in harshness or in identification, and really having a sense that this is a moment-to-moment exploration. You know, we really learn to liberate the moment and to empty the moment of clinging, and to empty the moment of selfing, you know, to empty the moment of contractedness. So let's take some time. Well, I think we'll start with a sitting and a walking period this morning, and then we'll go into some of the material. Ajahn Chah, who was one of the great teachers from the Thai forest tradition, was once asked what he saw when he looked out at the world and met with people, and how people were, how he found people. And he said, lost in thought. That was how he found people, lost in thought. Yeah? On another occasion, he was out walking with some of his students, and came across a very large boulder by the side of the path, and he asked his students, he says, "Do you think that boulder's very heavy?" And they answered, "It's really, really heavy. That's a really big boulder. It's really heavy." He says, "Only if you pick it up." We might consider this. Only if we pick it up. It's a means of just continuing just to settle into the day before we start reflecting on some of this material today, to take a walking period. But I really would encourage you to take into that walking period just a couple of really simple intentions. One is really sensing how much samatha is, or this inner collectedness is really a unifying and integrating of body, mind, and present moment. And this is when we're awake, you know, this is when we're truly present. And so to have that intention in the walking period, to actually sense when that integration, unification of body, mind, present moment is really there, and when it's not, and what has been the sort of fragmenting factor, and how often the fragmenting factor is actually simply becoming lost in thought. Simply becoming lost in thought. But also realizing that's never kind of the end of the story, isn't it? Mindfulness knows, it's not judging that it's that we're lost in thought. It's knowing. The moment we know we're lost in thought, we are no longer lost in thought. So it's the knowing of that, and actually being able to renew that intention of integrating, unifying body, mind, present moment, having our attention so established in the body walking, the body touching the ground, the body hearing, the body sensing. You know, it's no surprise at all that the body is never left behind in the development of mindfulness. You know, it's not as if there's a hierarchical exploration where we start with the body and then move on to the important business of the mind. The body is never, ever left behind. This is actually where our ground is always available to us, always available to us, just to find that sense of being able to be an embodied human being, to be an embodied human being. So we'll take some time for some walking. We'll come back at 10:15 and we'll begin with some of the material today. So if you could ring the bell around 10 after, thank you. So before we begin to reflect on the material or the discourse that I'd like to put in the center today, just want to check whether there's any questions that arose overnight about yesterday's material. Yes, please.
The idea that there's a way to interact with certain formations sort of beyond just watching, investigating, is pretty new for me. Do you have any advice for identifying when the gum has been chewed and it might be time to move to abandonment?
Okay. So the question is how do you identify when you've actually stayed with something, a pattern, long enough that the gum is being chewed, and when it's time then to move to abandonment? I think some of our repetitive patterns we need to learn how to visit, rather than to always just feel that we have to dive into, you know. So, you know, I mean, sometimes it very often happens in practice in life that we do become uncomfortably aware that, you know, there's a pattern that is really influencing and shaping our minds and our speech and our thoughts, and it doesn't serve us well. So when to investigate and how long to investigate? Not very long, I would suggest. you know? I mean, if there are new understandings coming forward from your investigation, this is obviously rich and fertile and serving you well. But if you visit that pattern and you find that the kind of narrative that comes is just being repetitive, you know, you might abandon it, not by sort of, and certainly not by pushing it away. You might first come to the body, you know, where is this pattern living in the body? That might be a way of kind of stepping out of thoughts that have just become, you know, basically closed feedback loops. You might come to the body. Is there a way that you sense this pattern manifesting in the body? So you spend some time with it, but when there is nothing new being revealed, you know, when you have some confidence that, yes, I know this, I know the conditions for it being present, I know the conditions for it arising, I can see how it's impacting and shaping, I can see that it leads actually to distress and to affliction, that's probably already enough information. You know, I'm not quite sure what else we would hope to discover. You know, and that might be the time when we see actually there's nothing new coming from this. This is now simply a habit, you know, a kind of a dried out husk. The metaphor that the Buddha uses is a butcher throwing a bone to a dog that's nothing on it. It's kind of one of those, you know, graphic metaphors. And the dog's chewing, hoping to get some juice out of this bone, and actually there's nothing there anymore. And so that would be your guideline. Is there something new being discovered? And just because you abandon it, please don't feel then that it just kindly cooperates and disappears, you know. It's very likely to revisit, and it may revisit with new information. It may revisit with new information. So, because, you know, habits do not disappear so quickly, psychological habits, it may revisit with new information, or it may revisit just simply as a repetition. You know, again, if it's new information, you investigate, you explore. But if it's just returning, then you really, with the same narrative, the same repetition, you're done with it. You know, you're actually done with it. You know, and then it's undoing the habit of dwelling on it. Yeah. Yes, please.
I was talking with my husband, who wasn't able to be here. He's an artist, a designer, and he often, when I talk about the obsession issues, often when I have a problem, you know, it becomes a bit of an obsession. He comes back and stays with him, but ideas do come through that. And, you know, I have my response for that, but I was curious what you think about the use of obsession or just letting things just kind of percolate until new ideas.
Is he talking about a creative process? Yeah. And I think this is something different than what we were talking about, although anything can turn into an obsession. I mean, often if we're going to create something or start some new venture, you know, of course there's thought involved in that, you know, and we need to give that time to ripen often. You know, the difference between a sort of creative process or a reflective process and the kind of obsession we were talking about yesterday is that if it's a creative, reflective process, you know, we have the freedom to put it down. The kind of obsession we were talking about yesterday is distinguished by the absence of that freedom. The apparent absence of that freedom. Yeah. Yes, please.
My question is, how do you know when you're present with the mind?
How do you know?
How do you know when you're present with the mind? I was trying to pay attention, and the body is pretty apparent to me, at least, but the mind. Thoughts went away, then maybe I was present with my mind, but I'm not sure. How do you tell when you're
it is developing that simple knowing that you know what's going on. No, the reality is that if you turn attention towards a thought, if that thought is not carrying the glue of identification, it will simply pass away. That's what attention does to thought. You know, if it's carrying the glue of identification, it won't just pass away. You know, you can still be knowing of it, but actually when it's carrying that glue, you're so quickly drawn into it. You know, so it really is about, it's developing a kind of literacy inwardly, I think a different kind of psychological literacy, you know, that you actually know the mood, the state of the mind, you know. That's one of the really important first steps, is to develop that kind of knowing. Ah, this is a mood of sadness. This is a mood of contractedness. This is a mood of calm. Also noticing really the lovely states of mind. So that's developing a kind of literacy inwardly. Because if you can begin to notice the state of mind, you will start to get much clearer about how that state of mind is then pervading the thoughts that arise from it. Okay.
So the state of the mind is really what you're talking about.
Absolutely. Oh, yes.
Going back to the cultivation concept you were speaking of, so cultivating a mind that's a friend, I feel more clear on the releasing or abandoning of feeding energy to an unskillful process. Is there a place for feeding energy to a skillful process?
Absolutely. So the question is, you know, being familiar with the territory of how feeding of difficult processes go on, is there a place for, in the realm of cultivation, of feeding the wholesome? Absolutely. Please do so every moment you can, you know. Because, you know, the way that our attention is hardwired to work is that we tend to preference with our attention that which is difficult or imperfect or broken or that somehow we dislike. We are not hardwired to preference the wholesome and the lovely and the liberating. So just really being aware of that. So this really does take quite a lot of intention and quite some effort to be actually begin to notice. And when you look at the skillful efforts in the lists that the Buddha speaks about, you know, deepening and sustain, you know, cultivating the wholesome that is not yet arisen, and deepening and sustaining the wholesome and skillful that is present. So, you know, there's a real art and a real, I think, real call to really explore the landscape of calm, or the landscape of stillness, or the landscape of kindness, you know, or the landscape of spaciousness. How do I know this? How does this feel? How is it registering? How is it changing how my sense doors are interfacing with the world, you know? To notice the moments of non-clinging, there are many moments in the day when we are absolutely not clinging, you know? There's many moments in the day when we're not selfing, you know, and again, they hardly sort of stand out for us, you know, whereas, you know, because they don't carry such a big voice as the unwholesome. So really orienting the attention towards that, cultivating what's not present and deepening and sustaining the lovely and the liberating that is pleasant. You know? It's almost building up a kind of cellular memory of what calm and stillness actually feels like. Because then we're much more able to draw upon that in the moments when, in moments of agitation or moments of restlessness.
It feels like that. So then the process you were talking about from the second sutra, moving away from something unskillful when you move towards something wholesome, can there be a letting go of the energy feeding of the unwholesome and a feeding of energy?
That's exactly what's happening. When you take your attention, as I was speaking about yesterday, when moving the attention from the unwholesome to something that is wholesome, there's obviously an energy switch in that. You know, you're no longer feeding the unwholesome. What you don't feed will actually begin to soften and pass, whereas the wholesome will deepen and become more steady. Yeah. Okay, so the discourse I want to reflect on, the sutta I want to reflect on today, is actually the shortest of all of the ones that I brought forward. And we're going to spend all day with it. Because I think it really touches upon some very perennial and important questions for us. It's called Jungle Thickets, and it's number 17 in the middle length saying. So I want to read it to you, because it isn't very long, and then we'll begin to unpack it. Bhikkhus, when you hear the word bhikkhus, please, this means men, women, everyone, it means all, okay? Bhikkhus, I shall teach you a discourse on jungle thickets. Listen and attend closely to what I shall say. Here, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu lives in some jungle thicket. While they are living there, their unestablished mindfulness does not become established. Their unconcentrated mind does not become concentrated. Their undestroyed taints do not come to destruction. They do not attain the unattained supreme security from bondage. And also, the requisites of life that should be obtained by one gone forth, robes, food, resting place, and medicine, they're hard to come by. The bhikkhu should consider thus: I'm living in this jungle thicket. While I'm living here, my unestablished mindfulness does not become established. I do not attain the supreme security from bondage, and it's pretty hard to get by. I'm going to paraphrase this a little bit, by the way. I don't have easy access to clothes, food, resting place, and medicine. That bhikkhu should depart from that jungle thicket that very night or that very day. They should not continue living there. Here, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu lives in some jungle thicket. While they're living there, their unestablished mindfulness does not become established. Their unconcentrated mind does not become concentrated. Their undestroyed taints do not come to destruction. They do not attain the unattained supreme security from bondage. Yet the requisites of life that need to be obtained are easy to come by. The bhikkhu should consider that thus: I am living in this jungle thicket. While I'm living here, my unestablished mindfulness does not become established, do not attain the unattained supreme security, and yet the requisites of life that I need are easy to come by. However, I did not go forth from the home life into homelessness for the sake of robes, food, resting place, and medicine. Moreover, while I'm living here, my unestablished mindfulness doesn't become established. I don't attain the unattained supreme security. Having reflected thus, the bhikkhu should depart from that jungle thicket. They should not continue living there. Here, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu lives in a jungle thicket. There's a little repetition here, you've noticed. Here, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu lives in some jungle thicket. While they're living there, their unestablished mindfulness becomes established. Their unconcentrated mind becomes concentrated. Their undestroyed taints come to destruction. They attain the unattained supreme security from bondage. Yet the requisites of life that should be obtained, food, medicine, clothing, resting place, yet the requisites are hard to come by. The bhikkhu should consider that thus: I'm living here. My mindfulness has become established. I have attained supreme security of bondage. Yet the requisites of life to get by are hard to come by. However, I did not go forth from the home life into homelessness for the sake of clothes, food, resting place, and medicine. Moreover, while I'm living here, my unestablished mindfulness has become established. I have attained supreme security. Having reflected thus, that bhikkhu should continue living in that jungle thicket. They should not depart. Here, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu lives in some jungle thicket, and while they're lying there, living there, their unestablished mindfulness becomes established, their unconcentrated mind becomes concentrated, their undestroyed taints come to destruction, they attain the unattained supreme security, and also the requisites of life that should be obtained by one gone forth are easy to come by. The bhikkhu should consider thus, I'm living here. Mindfulness is established, I've attained supreme security, and the requisites of life are easy to come by. That bhikkhu should continue living there. As long as life lasts, they should not depart. And then so you've registered those repetitions by now. So here, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu lives in dependence upon a certain village, and there's no progress, and requisites are hard to come by. Lives in dependence upon a certain town, lives in dependence upon a certain city, upon a certain country. A bhikkhu lives in dependence upon a certain person. That person should depart from that person if mindfulness has not become established and supreme security has not been found. Okay. So, let me summarize this a little bit. Because I think this really does come to this very perennial question, isn't it? And in some ways, it's a privileged question. You know, if we accept that much of the world doesn't necessarily have these choices about whether to stay or whether to leave, that much of the world does not have the choices to, you know, that freedom to move simply because they're not becoming liberated where they're living, you know. So accepting that it is a certain privileged question, however, of course, this question arose in a very unprivileged time and certainly in unprivileged lives. So to summarize it, you find that you're not making any progress and requisites are scarce. The instruction is to leave. You find that there's no progress and requisites are plentiful. You should leave. You find that both progress and requisites are progress is happening, but requisites are scarce. You should stay. You find you're making progress and requisites are plentiful. You should stay. This is, I think, the question that arises, I think, and I think this is true both inwardly and outwardly. How do we know when it's beneficial and helpful to stay with what is and for how long? And how do we know when it's beneficial to actually make changes, both in our lives and perhaps in our practice or perhaps in what we're depending upon? In terms of both conditions and people, how do we know to attend to this question of when to stay and when to go? So this discourse is very much speaking to our relationship to the world of conditions and not depending on the world of conditions to determine our well-being and freedom. Again, not being hostage to the world of conditions to make us happy, to deliver our satisfaction, to deliver a sense of identity that we're comfortable with, to deliver comfort and security. But it's also recognizing that we are not invulnerable to the world of conditions. You know, none of us has that kind of self-sufficiency in everything, that we are somehow not vulnerable to the world of conditions. We are, as we know. But this discourse also speaks to our relationship to the word progress. Ah. not a word we speak about very often in Western practices. It's a little bit of an allergy, isn't it? You know, it looks like comparing or evaluating or judging or, you know, being set up for failure or not feeling to be good enough, you know. It's an interesting one. There's many ways, I think, in Western practice that we kind of cherry pick from the discourses, you know, the things that are easier for us to hear than the things that are difficult for us to hear or challenging for us to hear because of our particular social, cultural conditioning and because of life experience. You know, we live in a world, you know, where we have very often been evaluated and compared and measured, and live in a world, many people, where, you know, they feel that they're not good enough or they're a failure or someone else is doing much better. So we've developed a sort of meditative culture, haven't we, where we don't really actually speak much about progress. We actually don't like the word goals. Even though the discourses are absolutely peppered with the word goals. We don't like the word striving, even though the discourses are absolutely pervaded with the encouragement to strive and not see it in a negative way or a self, you know, selfing way at all. But I think, we live in a world where we actually don't even talk about insights. Hardly, you know, it's almost a sort of an embarrassing subject, you know, if you turned up this morning and, you know, suddenly were asked to report on what insights you had yesterday, you know, or had on a retreat, we get a little, not sure, it might have been an insight, you know, what does an insight look like, you know, how do I know when I have one, you know, what are the insights I'm supposed to have even, you know. So we develop, I think, in a meditative culturally, these sort of kind of no-go areas. And I think if we're actually going to read the discourses or, you know, learn from the discourses, there's an encouragement to let go of those no-go areas. Ajahn Chah, you know, who's much quoted and has had quite an impact on many teachers and students in the West, you know, he said, you know, if you're not a stream enterer after practicing 5 years, something's amiss. Ah. And, you know, he wasn't saying that in any sort of kind of like heavy-handed way. He's just saying, you know, there are goals, there are aspirations, you know. There is a sense of direction in this path. And I think this discourse very much points to that sense of direction. Okay, so let's go back to the discourse, this phrase, jungle thickets. You know, this probably would have been a very real kind of environment for many people in India in the time of the Buddha. You know, it's hard to find jungles these days. But jungle thickets we also need to think of as being a metaphor of our lives and our minds. So the Buddha's really speaking about, you know, you're living in this kind of environment, inwardly and outwardly, that feels so dense, so tangled, so hard to see through, so hard to find a path through. You know, this is the jungle thickets. And, you know, our world is a kind of jungle thicket, I feel, you know. We live in a world, you know, certainly I feel in our culture, we live in a culture where, for example, greed has been normalized, even encouraged. This marks you out as being a successful human being, is the ability to satisfy your cravings. The ongoing encouragement to have more, get more, become more, accumulate more, hoard more, you know, fill yourself up more, supersize everything, you know. I feel, become kind of normalized to live in a state of wanting and pursuing, craving. And, you know, I fear that ill will is well on its way to being normalized. You know, it's actually the more that we listen to and are exposed to and repeat language of ill will, the less shocked we are by it. You know, we become somewhat desensitized to it. You know, it becomes almost normal. And there's plenty of confusion around. It's quite a jungle thicket, I think, we live in just now. And as much as we might wish to, we actually can't divorce ourselves from the world. And the Buddha never encouraged that in any way. He never encouraged his students to, you know, isolate themselves or to retreat to a cave. In fact, the Buddha ensured that monks and nuns could not do this by instituting the alms round. By instituting the alms round, he ensured that monks and nuns were always living in relationship, always living in dependence upon those around them. So there was never the opportunity, you know, to actually sort of disappear from that. The jungle thicket can also be seen as a metaphor for an untrained mind. I mean, does your mind ever feel like a jungle thicket where there's no clear way through and you can't see what's going on and it just feels so tangled and knotted and, you know, you don't know how to get out? You know, the jungle thicket of papancha, the proliferation we were talking about yesterday, the jungle thickets of the impulses and reactivity that seem to be so imprinted almost in our DNA, the jungle thicket of our habits that create and recreate distress and struggle, or just simply the jungle thicket of confusion, you know, of not quite knowing what is going on. But here we are, we live in the midst of all of this, and in the middle of all of this, in relationship to all of this, this is where we're endeavoring to embody our deepest values in our thoughts, our speech, our acts, our relationships. In the midst of all of this, this is where we're endeavoring to cultivate calm and mindfulness and kindness and compassion. This is where we're endeavoring to understand what it means to be free in the midst of all of this. Equanimity, the word in Pali, upekkha, translates as to be in the middle of. To be in the middle of. And this is, by the way, where we already are. Okay? But it's about how to be in the middle of. With poise, with balance, with understanding, with freedom. So this sense of jungle thickets, it's a timeless challenge, you know, it was as true today as it was 2,600 years ago. And we do know how our worlds can crumble in a moment. We all know this on some level, some very deeply and some less deeply. We know we're not in control of many of the conditions around us. We can't guarantee that we only have lovely, supportive people. We can't guarantee that we have rewarding work lives surrounded by friendly, inspiring, supportive colleagues. We can't control the unwelcome changes and losses we encounter and experience, the disappointment and, you know, the very vulnerability of our own bodies to aging and to sickness and to death. And every time we move away from that understanding into a place of trying to control the world of conditions, we move into agitation. Yeah. We move into anxiety, we move into contractedness. And I think it is so important to sense how that movement happens in our days, in our lives. You know, sometimes we hear it in the voices that, you know, say, this isn't fair, this shouldn't be happening. You know, sometimes we hear it in the voices of blame or you know, it's your fault. And sometimes we hear it in the voices simply of anxiety. You know, there's a Christian mystic once said, you know, that anxiety is the mood of ignorance. Anxiety is the mood of ignorance. And I think we can get a sense of that in our own experience when we the distortions we talked about yesterday, when we simply are not really aligned with life's rhythms, when we're not aligned with life's rhythms, we become anxious. We become anxious. And that anxiety sets off, doesn't it, and reinforces so many patterns of strategizing, rehearsing, planning, defending, trying to control what cannot be controlled. It does not mean we're helpless. It doesn't mean that we're helpless. And that is the, you know, I think that is one of the sort of mythologies that underlies the endeavor to control, the feeling that if we're not in control, we're going to be out of control and everything is going to spiral into chaos. Knowing we are not in control of conditions is also knowing we are not helpless, because we are part of that world of conditions. Yeah? Our paths, our understandings, our minds, our hearts are part of that world of conditions. And this is the place where we are not helpless. What we can take custody of, investigate, and understand is our relationship to the world of conditions that we're not invulnerable to. We're certainly not encouraged to seek invulnerability through numbness, or through dissociation or defensiveness. Again, what we talked about yesterday, the way that we are constantly touching and being touched by the world, every moment of our lives. Touching and being touched by the waves of conditions and sensory impressions that we live in the middle of. So this raises the question, how much effort should we make to change the world of conditions? And this is a question that has many implications, doesn't it? Social implications, political implications, you know, how we interface with the world. How much effort should we make to change the world of conditions? And as I mentioned, this is to some degree a privileged question, considering that the majority of people in the world have no power to change the appalling conditions of poverty or war or oppression or disease that they live in the middle of. Yet this may not be the reality for us in this moment. We may have many more choices than most of the world. And with those choices, I think there's a certain freedom to be grateful for. There's a certain freedom to be grateful for. How do you know when to stay within a job or a relationship that no longer inspires you or supports you, and when it's right to make changes? How do you know, when to get your kind of marching boots out, you know, because the world of social conditions or political conditions is so unacceptable? How do we know when to simply stay present within the unacceptable, politically, socially, and when to commit actually to making changes and to being a part of making changes? Are these obvious questions to you? I mean, do these questions trouble you at all? One thing is very easily forgotten is that the Buddha was as much a social activist as he was a contemplative. Again, I think this is often overlooked, and you know, in particularly in Western Dharma, when we become actually, you know, primarily focused upon formal practice and, you know, Eightfold Path, inner development. it is easy to forget how, you know, much of the Buddha's life was actually concerned with social change as well as with inner change. So he certainly was not a promoter of passivity, you know, of sitting back and just saying, well, that's the way it is, you know, or this is what I have to accept, this is what I have to learn to accept. Instead, the encouragement of the Buddha was to consistently engage with the world with all of its pain and to commit to the uprooting of that suffering through our words, our acts, and our choices. The Buddha did not encourage anyone to sit on the sidelines of life simply observing, but to stand in the middle of as a responsive and caring human being. This is the task of a path. We might not think of it as being the task of meditation, but then actually if we think of meditation as being the whole of the path, we've missed out a lot. Yeah? Because half of the path is about how we engage with the world. It is also recognizing that we never walk this path alone, but in the midst of our communities, our societies, our families, and our wider world. So the path is really twofold. This question of bhavana, this word bhavana, the word cultivation. To cultivate that is lovely and liberating for our own well-being, but also for the well-being of all. The Buddha very much stressed, you know, that we do not practice for ourselves. That we practice for people we love, and that we practice for people we don't know, and that we practice maybe even more so for the people that we struggle with. So part of that practice, that cultivation is inner, it's resourcing ourselves. It's developing a sense of capacity. It's bringing seeds of potentiality to maturity, of kindness, of equanimity, of joy, of compassion. It's bringing seeds of potentiality to fruition inwardly. And then this is how we are interfacing with life. It's being aware that we are always practicing something. Always. You know, there's not a moment when we're not practicing something. And if we're not actually cultivating that which is liberating and healing and lovely, it's very likely we're practicing our habits. Yeah? That we're practicing that well-traveled ground. Now, these two dimensions of the path, how we interface with the world outwardly and how we interface with the world inwardly, these are not hierarchical. You know, we do not wait until we are perfectly accomplished in compassion, perfectly accomplished in generosity, perfectly accomplished in kindness and mindfulness before we learn to live with compassion, generosity, kindness, and compassion. I think that the part of the Buddhist teaching that is, you know, not so palatable to many people in the West is his questioning of the myth of authenticity. You know, that we actually feel that we're only authentic if we feel something. That if we don't feel something, we're somehow not authentic. This has nothing to do with, when you look at the Buddha's teaching, how much of it is actually behavior-led? How much of it is behavior-led? You know, undertaking, for example, a commitment to the precepts. This is behavior-led. You know, we don't have to feel like not harming. You know, we don't have to feel like not stealing. You know, we don't have to feel like not killing or not lying in order to act in a way where we're not harming and we're not stealing and we're not lying and we're honest. And the Buddha, I think, was, you know, I mean, it's not so unlike many Western psychological practices. You know. You actually set the intention, you set the behavior, and then your mind is at some point going to catch up. Your mind at some point is going to catch up. But the Buddha put this all across the path. He said, you know, I remember one of my early teachers, you know, listening to someone saying, I don't feel compassion. And the teacher scratching his head and says, what's that got to do with anything? What has that got to do with anything? You know, and it is why many people, for example, struggle with metta practice, because they don't feel it. You don't have to feel it in order to live with kindness. Like people make generosity into some very complicated exploration. I don't feel generous. What has that got to do with anything? Yeah? In order to be generous. You know, we recognize, you know, these loops, the interface of, you know, behavioral patterns and mind and body, you know, and how one is feeding the other and learning from the other, you know, both from the wholesome and the unwholesome. If we act with generosity, this sends a certain message to the mind. It's very akin, you know, to why we ask people to, you know, have a posture of wakefulness, even when the mind doesn't feel like it. You know? It sends a message to the mind. Might be a good idea to wake up. Could you imagine on retreats, you know, if we said to people, oh, only come and sit if you really, really feel like it, you know. If you don't feel like it, you know, just do something else, you know. Or only walk, you know, if you really feel like walking, meditation, you know. Otherwise, just never mind, you know. No, you know, if we said that, we'd have empty halls, wouldn't we? A lot of the time, you know. And yet how many times we actually don't subscribe to that myth that authenticity is dependent upon how we feel in some of the most, you know, really crucial situations of our life. Any of you have been a parent, you know, you get up in the middle of the night to take care of a child, you don't feel like it. You do it because you're actually being led by your deepest values rather than your current feeling. You look after a friend in trouble, you know, you may not feel like it, but you act out of your deepest values rather than what you feel in the moment. Now, I think this is really it's such an important kind of piece of beginning to develop this sense of how we are interfacing with the world, both inwardly and outwardly, you know, where I think culturally we've been more prone to kind of put how we feel on a kind of altar, and actually in the path we're asked to put at the forefront of our lives, our intentions and our values, even when we don't feel like it. So pause a moment, anybody got any reflections? Yeah.
Well, I am just thinking of the definition of compassion, the quivering, where they talk about the quivering heart, which to me feels like a feeling. But at times you can just know that maybe you don't actually feel it, but you know that if you were that person, you would feel.
With all of the Brahmaviharas, there are two parts. Sometimes there is an affective tone. You know, sometimes there's an affective tone to metta or to compassion. That's not what's most significant. What is most significant is the intention. You know, in that cultivation, we're not trying to recover that affective tone, but actually to put it out as an intention, as you say.
That's helpful to me because sometimes I don't feel, but... And then I feel bad I got the second arrow because I didn't feel it. Then I feel bad that I didn't feel it.
Yeah.
Even if I'm acting.
Yeah. You don't have to feel it.
How might we distinguish, this was a conversation this morning that we were having actually, between acting without the feeling there and... Performing or falsifying.
Pretending.
Yeah.
But it depends if you're pretending to feel something. I mean, if we pretend to feel something, we're always going to get found out. you know, and it's pretty evident to others, and it's pretending pretty evident to ourselves, you know. Yes, and I mean it's really awful. It's terrible, isn't it? Where somebody writes you a nasty note and signs it "Meta." You know, or you know, with gritted teeth. You know, I'm really saying this because I really care about you. It's always evident. You know, it's in a way quite difficult to falsify feelings, you know, or pretend feelings. So, it's a question of whether we're acting, pretending we feel a particular way, or whether we're acting because actually this is the most skillful and the most helpful and the most wholesome way to act just now. And we don't have to feel anything or pretend we feel anything at all. You know, we may be quite honest inwardly and actually say, well, you know, I don't actually feel like this, or I don't feel this. But I'm not feeling led.
I find a lot of this troubling, just in the sense that I'm thinking about our current political and the environment that we live in as a social, the construct of the world that we live in, and the laws that we agree to live by, so that we can live as citizens of the world together, people who have different views from us, and not do harm to each other, and how it feels as though that acting as if now, because we have those laws in place that we don't do harm to each other when the light is green and not red, we don't shoot at each other, that a lot of that's getting ripped apart now, and the understanding that we have of how we live in the world is shifting.
Yes.
Becoming much more, oh, there. And we don't have this inner core of this path to follow. And the social structure that held us together is being violated so much.
Yeah. It's a jungle thicket. It is a jungle thicket, and it is troubling. And it's right that we should be troubled, or that we feel troubled, you know, or that we question. Yeah. But we'll continue to explore this theme. You know, how do we act? How do we know when to act? How do we know when to stay with? You know, I mean that's become, you know, unfortunately it's a little bit of a command structure. Certainly within I think contemporary mindfulness often, you know, because I know that world very well, and I think also within meditative worlds, you know, just stay with, you know, just stay with. As if this is a kind of one-dimensional form of effort, you know, and it's not. But we will continue that discussion.
One more thing, which seems to go with this. You were talking about the Buddha had a list of things like confidence and self-respect that he felt were very helpful to practice. So to me, that's part of the way of choosing, like, hold with the difficult, you know, and you want to look at it and stay with it and so forth. But at a point, if you're losing all confidence and self-respect, and I can't remember the other...
Ethics is one of them.
Yeah, that would be an indication that...
it's time to make a change.
Yes.
Yeah, there's many indicators. Let's go on just a little bit, okay. So... In this discourse, the Buddha is really, you know, applying this investigation first to the important question of, do we feel we're making progress on the path? Do we feel we're regressing? Or do we feel like we're treading water? And pretty much staying the same. So the Buddha really encouraged, this is a very simple question, but of course it becomes very charged, you know, because it's hard for us to ask that question of ourselves without it becoming surrounded by a whole load of selfing, you know, a whole lot of selfing and fears of failure and, you know, not being good enough. But I think it is actually an important question. Do we feel we're progressing on the path? Do we feel we're regressing? Or do we feel that we're treading water? Bearing in mind that nobody's development on this path is always linear, okay? There's ups, there's downs, there's valleys, there's peaks, you know. And yet, overall, if we stand back, do we see things falling away? Do we see things falling away? I think we need to get past that, this place of, you know, being afraid of opening the door to a world of judgment, comparing. I think we can get past this. You know, Plato, as many of you know, wrote that an unexamined life is not worth living. I think the statement is that only in striving to know and understand ourselves do our lives have meaning or value. I think we can apply this to our path and our practice. For our path and our practice to have meaning and value, it very much merits being examined. You know, times when we stand back. Not that we stand back at the end of every sitting and say, well, how would that one go? You know, it's a progress, regression, treading water, you know. But that we have this kind of times where we stand back and say, you know, where are we going? What is our sense of aspiration? Is that coming more into visibility? Does it seem to be disappearing from visibility? Do we just feel like we're kind of plateauing? If we recognize that most of us, I think probably all of us actually, do not begin this journey and practice in order to stay the same. Most of us don't do this in order to be more intimately acquainted with our chaos and our habit patterns or our own jungle thickets. Even, most of us do this, don't do this even to just get the capacity to observe or watch our jungle thickets more mindfully. That's even more discouraging. And we don't do this just to get less upset by our jungle thickets. Just so that we don't get upset by them. Most of us aspire for change. You know, most of us aspire for transformation. And these are called kusala, or wholesome or noble desires. And very much encouraged and supported and acknowledged of the need to have wholesome desires, really, at the center of much of what we do in our lives, but certainly in the center of what we do in this path, to cultivate this chanda, this kusala chanda, this wholesome desire, this sense of longing. You know, I think sometimes, again, in our culturally, we tend to sort of have a blanket ban on desire as being, you know, always bad, but actually there's so many different strata of desire. And, you know, the only one that the Buddha isolates as being, you know, pretty toxic is craving. Tanha, the unquenchable. The difference between tanha and a wholesome desire is tanha has no answer, can never be satisfied, whereas wholesome desires have an answer. And they can indeed be satisfied. So our wholesome desires are actually to be formulated in our minds, to be articulated, to be respected, to be valued, to be committed to. Our aspirations and our desires probably do change over time with experience and with practice. You know, many people begin the path, you know, with some... just looking for more calm and more steadiness, more peace. There's nothing amiss with that, you know. Many people don't begin the path or the practice with the desire for liberation or awakening. They just like to actually find some kind of anchor or some kind of steadiness. And this is absolutely fine, you know. And hopefully with practice, we actually see this come into being. You know, born of our practice, born of our efforts, born of our commitments, suddenly there is more peace, or there is more calm. There is more wakefulness. And we might aspire, just come into the practice aspiring to be a kinder or a more compassionate person. And hopefully we see this come into being through practice and through commitment. We may wish to be less reactive and impulsive, and hopefully we see this come into being. This is called progress. This is called progress. And if you really look at sort of many of the maps of awakening presented by the Buddha, they're maps which really describe the coming into being and the falling away. Yeah? The falling away of the habitual, the falling away of the reactive, the falling away of that which causes suffering, the coming into being of that which actually heals, that which liberates. But there's a real distinguishing, many of the maps of awakening really actually distinguish what falls away, and the kind of order that things fall away on. But this is called progress. And our aspirations may very well, and hopefully do grow, to have more confidence and a sense of awakening, of liberation, to know the same insights as the Buddha knew. And I do feel there's something quite important about considering ourselves to be students of Nibbana. Considering ourselves to be students of Nibbana, because the Buddha certainly never sought for eternal and perpetual students. He really sought for graduates. Really sought for graduates. And I think aspiration is a wholesome desire we learn to have confidence in. I mean, sometimes we hear a lot of cautions about, ambition, striving, expectation. And I have mixed feelings about that. I mean, certainly I can see that can be very toxic for people who are, very much sort of conditioned into becoming. But I don't actually see so many people with really inflated expectations in this path. I see more people with deflated expectation. Deflated expectation, sort of a sense that no, awakening is like a historical story, and not possible for me, and more calm would be great, but I see much more in terms of deflated expectation. Pause a moment. We'll move on. You're very quiet.
This thing about the Ajahn Chah saying, if you haven't become a stream emptier entering 5 years, there's something wrong. And then this other side, which is the deflated expectation. Do you think that in Southeast Asia, or in the cultures where Buddhism, its roots are, that they do not have these deflated expectations? It's the complexity of our culture with all of its various conflicting messages of be so much but don't be that, be that much.
Yeah. Did you hear the question? So the question is this sense of deflated expectation much less, say, in cultures such as in Southeast Asia, that have less constructs around selfing and becoming and all of that. I don't know. I would say probably, no, you can't make that generalization, because, if you look in Southeast Asia, they've got their own cultural issues that create deflated expectation, and one of the issues, say, for in Southeast Asia or in many of the, very Buddhist countries is that there's a very big division between lay life and monastic life. And monastics are the ones who get awakened, and lay life has faith. So it's a different cultural concept. That creates this sort of sense of impossibility or deflated expectations. Ours, I think, so it's probably quite unique, specific to cultures, actually, how, you know, and a lot of it is, you know, that very creepy, subtle interplay of mana, you know, of being not good enough, you know, inferior to, not able, you know, how that plays into that. But I think there's just different cultural takes on this, you know. And so the Buddha was, the Buddha actually really did actually sort of push against those hierarchies, you know, very strongly in terms of actually social change, you know, actually redefining what a Brahmin was. You know, in his time, it was the Brahmins who held all of the kind of, you know, authority and respect. And he redefined what a Brahmin was by how they act and how they live, not by how they're born. You know, so he was constantly pushing against these social constructs that delivered deflated or inflated sense of self and expectations. And I think that, you know, the fact that it's spoken about so much in the discourses probably actually speaks to how much it's not just a cultural construct, but how cultural constructs are, you know, have a particular flavor of the mind's wish and patterning and tendency to actually lower one's sense of possibility in relationship to others. Yeah.
So some years ago on retreat, I remember you also brought up our deflated expectations about the path, and I took that to heart, and I've been looking at that for some years. And what's come up for me is a development of more of a faith in the path, that every time I'm aware that the Dharma is like doing me, or that's what's really happened, that there's some wisdom or grace or something that I didn't feel like I did, but
okay,
it happened, and there was clarity and bigger heart or sense of yes.
Yeah.
You know, that there's, that it's almost like I still haven't set my goal of, you know, of liberation, but I feel like I've, like, invested in the faith.
Yes, and I think probably the faith and the possibility of liberation is probably rooted in experience, because I'm pretty confident that all of you here who have been on this path for some time can quite honestly step back and say you have seen things fall away. One thing that falls away is doubt.
Well, and yet probably doubt is the biggest thing that I... that habit and tangle, my thicket feels like doubt.
But not in the path.
Right.
Isn't that interesting?
It's something that
was
a doubt.
Yeah. Oh.
More to contemplate.
Oh. And I'm sure all of you would be able to say, yes, I've seen things fall away, you know, because this is actually the nature of insight is for most people not big epiphany moments. The nature of insight for most people is a very gentle, quietening, deepening of understanding that sometimes you don't even realize something that has been understood until you walk into Thanksgiving dinner, for example, and realize that you're not wanting to shout at your mother or that what a family member says to you can go straight by, and it's absolutely fine. You don't realize something has fallen away until actually you go into a situation that was previously laced with a certain kind of reactivity, and it's just not there anymore. You know? You can sit in an airport without sort of, you know, checking your watch every 2 minutes. You know, you can do many things actually that suddenly realize, gosh, there's more patience. There's more kindness. There's more easefulness. You know, that there's less anxiety. Isn't that interesting? When did that change? And you can't put your finger on a moment when it changed.
I want to thank you for those examples, because I think that sometimes in perhaps our hardwired looking for
back, right? Looking for the things that we can't do. And I find that sometimes in community or group, I'm thinking in particular of a retreat at IMS, where in a small group we're like, oh my God, you know, are we able to be enlightened? And the ability to be able to speak to the small things in a positive way and to see them as progress, I think it's really overshadowed by the difficulty.
Absolutely.
And I think just having a way in a group to share the small things,
yeah,
you know, the value of those small things.
Absolutely. Learning to have appreciative joy inwardly, to celebrate those moments, and even calling them small is probably not helpful. To celebrate those moments, actually, when you see actually something has shifted. What is different culturally in Southeast Asia is the normalization of the language of awakening and liberation. The normalization of that, you know, that it's just it's just everyday conversation, you know. If you go into an English village and ask, you know, where's your nearest church, you know, somebody would say, go down the corner, turn right. You know, if you go into a monastery in Burma and Thailand and say, you know, where's your nearest stream enter or aunt, they'd say, go down the corner and turn right. You know, it's just much more of a normal conversation. Whereas culturally, I think in the West, it's not at all a normal conversation. It's much more a sort of almost a taboo zone, you know. And I think there is a virtue to the normalization of the language and the sense of possibility and what really is the goal of the path. I mean, there are many, many goals of the path. You know, there's not just one. But actually, the Buddha's, the centrality of the Buddha's teaching is, you know, there is dukkha, there's an end to dukkha. You know, we must not skip over the third noble truth. Yeah.
So I'm just listening to you again, and trying to listen through the lens of the privilege and whatnot, and in terms of what's happening in Myanmar and Southeast Asia now, trying to find some understanding around some of that because it's so conflicting with my Buddhist view, and yet in a Buddhist country such horrible things are happening. So I'm trying to find some way around that, around that. I'm just wondering what your thoughts are.
Well, I mean, I don't want to go into the detail. There's quite a lot of detail that, but we mustn't romanticize Buddhist cultures. You know, we mustn't romanticize Buddhist cultures. You know, Buddhist cultures are made up of people's minds. So it's very important not to romanticize them, imagine them as being some sort of ideal of, you know, peace and love and there are many wonderful things in Buddhist cultures, but there's many wonderful things in our culture also, isn't it? But we mustn't romanticize it and think, well, okay, all greed and hatred and delusion has sort of come to an end, and particularly not because someone puts on a robe. Okay? The Buddha was constantly sort of in dispute with his own bhikkhus because they were, you know, he was constantly saying a robe does not make a bhikkhu. You know, a life makes a bhikkhu. You know, I mean, you think, you know, 100 years after the Buddha's death, you know, there was a great monastery clean out. You know, because you know so many people had, you know, chosen this as a lifestyle. You know, which in a very poor country, you know, you got fed, which we'll actually go into this. You know, and weren't actually practicing or living the life of a contemplative. You know, so let's not romanticize, but people's minds, greed, hatred, and delusion are not confined.
And in that sense of not romanticizing, I think that do you have any sense of the monastic response to what's happening?
Yeah, because the only monastics that get any airtime are actually this particular... The only monastics that get any airtime is this particular group in Myanmar and in Burma that are well known for being unruly and not contemplative. The other, there are many monastics who do not get any airtime at all, who are just so deeply horrified and appalled by what is going on. But this is not who gets the airtime. Okay. So let's go back to jungle thickets, where we are. So we live, this is one scenario, okay? We live in a jungle thicket where our unestablished mindfulness does not become established. Okay? Our uncollected mind does not become collected. Our patterns of confusion, craving, ill will, and selfing persist, and we do not attain liberation. On top of this, our essential needs are hard to come by. That bhikkhuni, should depart that very day. They should not continue living there. How does this apply to us? Because it just seems to be describing a life of struggle, doesn't it? You know, we're not getting by and our mindfulness is not established, you know, all the rest of it. How does this apply to us? On one level, it's quite reductionist, isn't it? Because, you know, you think of us, most of us here probably have food, we have shelter, we have access to medicine, although that's a little bit more iffy in your country. Most of us have food, shelter, medicine, and clothing. We have what, most of us have what we need to survive. And I'm being aware, I'm very aware of speaking, you know, as we live next to a tent city, you know. Most of us have what we need to survive. Do we have what we need to thrive? You know, I think that these are two different things. Most of us, if we're fortunate, we have what we need to survive. Do we have what we need to thrive? If our survival is ensured, you know, the fact that we're not having to, you know, struggle for food and clothing and shelter and medicine every day. If our survival is ensured, yet still we don't feel that we thrive or feel ourselves to be making progress, what changes do we need to make? What changes do we need to make? I think because progress on the path, and I hope you can hear the word progress without sort of, you know, chomping on it. Progress on the path has something to do with us cultivating the optimal inner and outer conditions for us to thrive and to incline the mind towards awakening. So this is a question of thriving. We don't practice in a vacuum. We're not invulnerable. If we, for example, this is very partner good example to many. If we live a chaotic, overstretched, overbusy life, how do we thrive? Where are the optimal inner conditions for awakening? Sometimes we need to make outer changes for inner change to happen. You know, as I mentioned, so much of this practice is actually behavior level. You know, trying to imagine, you know, or just use the mindfulness mantra, you know, just be with what is, be with what is, and meanwhile we don't even have a space to breathe. You know, how do we really anticipate progress in the path being made if we just feel like we're hanging on to our life by our fingernails? You know, where we're tired and wired. You know, where in the evenings we can hardly do more than just sort of, you know, roll into bed. You know, where the energy is so depleted. I mean, I think these are really big questions because, again, they're almost privileged questions, aren't they? Some people have no choices except to be overstretched and overburdened. You know, some people do have choices. You know, are we cultivating the optimal outer conditions in terms of ethics? You know, are we providing the conditions for unpleasant or pleasant mind states to arise? You know, Are we cultivating the conditions for difficult, struggling mind states to arise, or ones that are easeful? How much does the word need become centralized in our life? You know, in the ordained community, of course, this is reductionist. You know, you have those four things: food, shelter, clothes, medicine. You know, that's what you need. You know, culturally, we're much more trained to have a much bigger catalogue of needs, aren't we? You know, what I need to be happy, what I need to be able to rest, what I need to be able to be easeful, what I need to have in place before I let go. That's a big one, isn't it? What I need to have in place before I begin to practice renunciation. These are huge challenges for lay people. You know, we don't live in that cloistered world. You know, we live in a world where need can feel almost bottomless. Need can feel almost endless. If we have what we need externally, what are the conditions inwardly that lead us to feeling stuck or not making progress? You know, and I think that's a good question. You know, we look at our life. Do we have what we need, actually? Not to be struggling, not to be bereft, not to be worried about living. If we have what we need, then what are the conditions inwardly that may need to change in order for us to feel that we're actually making progress, that we're not stuck? Today I'm just going to raise a whole load of questions. I'm not going to give any answers. You know, I'm going to raise a whole load of questions and just throw them out there. And they're not always comfortable questions. How much are we in a cycle of being need driven? You know, I just need to make this change or that change or get rid of this, you know, or fix that. And then I'm going to have everything that I need in place. And then I'm really going to start letting go. And I'm really going to, you know, be a renunciate, and I'm really going to be able to practice. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know, that this one need in order to thrive. I look around me and I see a lot of people suffering, disease, loss, death, separation, things like that. I live a pretty comfortable life. And sometimes I wonder whether my challenge is it's been too easy. That sometimes
we're getting to that. We are getting to that, you know, how easily we can fall asleep. How easy we can fall asleep. How easily calm can even slide into complacency. You know, like I'm undisturbed. Great, you know, this is my nibbana. You know, I'm comfortable. This is my nibbana, you know, and it's a really important question, a good question. I think it's time for a stretch. So let's return to these jungle thickets. I know when we hear this teaching, it does sound like statements of privilege, you know, that we should all just have these choices to move, to make changes. And then I remind myself that the Buddha offered these teachings in a society and time, actually, when there was very little privilege. And in terms of the privilege ladder, the ordained Sangha would have been on the bottom of that ladder. You know, they were essentially beggars in terms of how they lived. They were essentially beggars. So in the first scenario that the Buddha painted or portrayed, he really talks about two things. That, first of all, the practice is untogether. The mind is not focused or collective. Nothing is falling away. You know, there is no insight. Then there is no movement towards liberation. And the other factor that he's talking about is that conditions are so deeply unsupportive. You know, they're simply not getting what they even their basic needs met. And, you know, we need to translate this into our world and our lives today, you know, that, okay, when we assess or take an honest look at our practice and see, well, you know, none of these things are happening. You know, my mindfulness is not established, collectedness is uncollected, nothing is falling away, and I feel like there's no steps being made towards liberation. And then perhaps I look at my life, you know, and I'm not a beggar, but it may be that my life is so unsupportive for deepening, that my life is perhaps so chaotic or so disorganized or so overfull that there is nothing there that is actually supporting any inner movement at all. In fact, probably the exact opposite. Probably so much energy is having to go in just to manage this disorganized or unnourishing or unsupportive life that there's not even any possibility of deepening. And the Buddhist suggestion here is, you know, like, this is not about endurance. It's not about enduring the unendurable. You know, I see many, many times people stay within, you know, lifestyles and situations that are, you know, so chaotic and so unsupportive, and yet somehow they have a kind of inner voice probably inherited early on in their years that either they deserve this lack of support or this lack of deserve this chaos, or simply there's some inner voice that says, you know, endurance is a virtue, and endurance and, you know, forbearance in this teaching is very much a virtue, the capacity to bear with the difficult, to have the patience to bear with the difficult. But I think this is very, very different than this mind of enduring as a virtue, as if there's some kind of nobility in suffering. You know, as if there's a kind of nobility in that kind of distress. You know, and we can be quite conditioned into this. You know, here we all have our own crosses to bear, you know, our own crosses to carry. So endurance can be seen as a sort of virtue or as a kind of nobility. The fact is that actually we just get stuck with it, and, you know, we actually just get into this kind of self-viewing of somehow not thriving is okay, you know, or not thriving is okay. So that's the first jungle thicket. And actually the Buddha says, you know, you should make changes. You should make changes. You should attend to how your life is, you know. Whatever is not prescriptive about those changes, but actually you should make changes. You should not stay within this environment and this context, you know. It's up to anyone what those changes might be, but it kind of challenges this idea that somehow we're invulnerable to the world of conditions, which of course we are not. Of course we are not. Then we get into the second jungle thicket, which is kind of more, it's also quite interesting. And I'll read it to you again. A bhikkhu living in some jungle thicket, there his unestablished mindfulness does not become established, his unconcentrated mind does not become concentrated, his undestroyed taints do not come to destruction, they do not attain the unattained supreme security from bondage, yet the requisites of life that are needed are easy to come by. The bhikkhu should consider, here I am living here, and all of those things are not happening. My mindfulness is not established, I'm not free. And I've got what I need. And then they remember, I didn't actually go forth from the home life into homelessness for the sake of robes, for the sake of food, for the sake of resting place, for the sake of medicine. Moreover, while I'm living here, my unestablished mindfulness does not become established, and that bhikkhu should depart from that jungle thicket. That bhikkhu should not continue living there. So this one is kind of, you know, life, it really is actually, I think, a warning about complacency. Yeah? I mean, in the time of the Buddha, I mean, there's a historical context for this, because in the time of the Buddha, many people were simply just surviving, you know, and having enough food and a roof over your head and medicine and clothing would actually be doing pretty good, you know, doing pretty well. That would, you know, if you're not struggling to get all that together, you're actually doing pretty well. So the Buddha's actually, you know, cautioning and encouraging people to remember. So even moving into an ordained life, given the conditions of that time, offered a certain security. It offered a certain security. You know, people would support the monastics. But then the Buddha's saying, remember, this is actually not why I did this. You know, I didn't do this in order to be more secure. You know? I didn't do this in order to feel that somehow I was exempted from struggle. But I think we transfer this into our life, and I know this was brought up just before lunch, you know, about being too comfortable. You know, I think it's a little bit of a cautioning against complacency. And I mean, I think we all know that kind of peril, you know, like we don't have any immediate challenges on the horizon, you know, life is going fairly smoothly, you know, and we kind of can easily just go to sleep a little bit. It's a sort of enlightened retirement. Well, not an unenlightened retirement, you know. It's kind of like, I don't really need to have those aspirations. You know, I have enough. I'm not desperate, you know. I'm fairly comfortable. You know, maybe I could just give up all this efforting all the time, you know, and trying to be mindful, you know, and just sort of hang out here in this kind of, you know, relative comfort, you know. I mean, I'm going to, you know, have a little sit every now and then, you know, just to keep my credentials up to date, you know. But not really feeling like we're actually stretching any boundaries, or not really seeing that we're... I mean, sometimes, you know, life comes along and stretches all of our boundaries, you know, and all of our edges. And there are other times when that is actually not so, you know. And, you know, we're kind of cruising, you know, or we're on cruise control, you know. We're just kind of sidling along. And the perils of this as we go to sleep, we actually often see how motivated we are to practice by crisis. You know, I call it emergency meditation. You know, things are going really badly in our life, or there's some great difficulty, you know, and we're feeling very, very life battered. And, you know, we say, you know, where is the nearest cushion? You know, where's the next retreat? We suddenly become very, very motivated. And yet, sometimes when the crisis is over, we step back into a sense of relief, which is very welcome. But almost a sense of this is good enough, you know? Got a little calm in place, you know? You know, less agitation, less worried. Mind feels a little bit easier. But it's remembering that complacency is not the same as contentment. Complacency is not the same as contentment. Contentment indeed, and gratitude indeed, are great virtues, you know, to appreciate those times in our life when we feel supported and have enough and are not struggling, to, you know, to feel gratitude for that and to feel the contentment that we can find within these places. But contentment is not the same as complacency. And the Buddha reminds, I didn't begin this path in order to find security and comfort. And the same refrain is repeated. If in that comfort or that absence of struggle, we do find that unestablished mindfulness does not become established, that the uncollected mind does not become collected, you know, that the unwholesome states and patterns are still rising, and I'm not free, I should depart. Now, this is not meaning that we should leave our homes, you know, and our marriages and our families, but we should depart from complacency. We should depart from complacency. And it's a kind of a metaphor for asking what really needs to change for us to establish mindfulness and collectedness, to see the uprooting of patterns rather than just the abeyance of them. Rather than just the abeyance of them. And to find an abiding freedom. So this is often where we actually really begin to ask, I think, very real questions about our own sense of aspiration, our own sense of inspiration, and actually the kind of identities we hold that, you know, might tell us that somehow we're excluded from awakening, you know, and what kind of efforts we actually bring to our practice. How much do we have an edge? I would call it an edge in our practice that actually stretches us. So there's some clear guidelines, I think, that are being offered in this. Is mindfulness established? Is mindfulness established? And what does that mean for us? What does that look like for us? I think when the Buddha speaks about mindfulness being established, he's not talking about episodic bouts of mindfulness, but an abiding mindfulness established. Is collectedness established? You know, the key word here is established. Is collectedness established? You know, do we find that mind of a friend, you know, really showing up for us? Where, you know, we're not so prone or not so interested in distractedness or infatuation. Where there's that sense of being able to find this integration of body, mind, present moment. Are our unhelpful patterns falling away? Are they beginning to disappear? This again doesn't happen in some startling moment of insight, but because of sustained investigation and sustained effort and sustained cultivation. Have I not attained the supreme security from bondage? And I think we see this liberation in two ways. The feeling of being free from and the freedom to. The freedom to engage with the world, with compassion, with creativity, with kindness, with courage. And remembering that we don't start with unshakable liberation. We start with very shaky liberation, you know, and little moments and little tastes and little glimpses. But are we inspired enough by those tastes and those glimpses to really actually be feeling that we're moving towards, moving in a direction of attaining the unshakable security from bondage? So, and if not, what does it mean for us to depart? What does it mean for us to change, you know? What would we throw into this mixture? You know, I've got a pretty good life, you know, pretty comfortable, you know, no, you know, if this is true for anybody. You know, I've got no big crises on the horizon, you know. I you know, you might have good friends, good sanghas, you know, good sense of community, good sense of family. What would you bring into that mix to actually make help you to feel truly on a path of awakening? There's dangers in not bringing those edges in, because when we fall into complacency or fall into sort of like just kind of hanging out in the comfort zone, we are gradually whittling away our inner resources. And when that crisis comes along, which it will do, we are suddenly wondering, but I've practiced all these years. Why am I not better at this, you know, dealing with this difficulty or this crisis? So it's really a question to you. What gets thrown into that mix? Because, you know, you don't necessarily want to seek being uncomfortable. Please, life brings enough of this along. Huh? This is not the edge. You don't want to seek discomfort as if that is some, you know, find your own bed of nails to lie down on periodically. And we don't want to start engaging in mortification practices, you know, to wake us up. But what do we actually bring into that that more easeful life, which we need to be grateful for, to actually have that spark of inspiration or that spark of creativity or that spark of investigation where we really feel we are actually genuinely on a path of awakening and these things are happening. Mindfulness is beginning to be established. Collectedness is beginning to be established. Things are falling away. And we are glimpsing that taste of freedom. So that's my question to you, if anybody's in that situation, you know, where they have what they need and they're not having to struggle to pay the grocery bill and, you know, they have enough heat and you know, if anybody's in that comfort zone, what keeps you alive? What keeps you awake? What keeps you on a sense of having a path that you're truly cultivating of wakefulness? It is a question, yes.
I think for me it's as I encounter situations, people, difficulties in daily life, it's really bringing practice to that. Like anything is the teacher, you know, whatever's in front of me. And really, you know, noticing the reaction that might be internal before it, luckily, hopefully, before it's happened, not always. And then really bringing a Dharma lens to whatever's happening in front of me and really working.
And what inspires you to do that? Where does that arise from?
Because when I do that, things come out much better.
Okay. Okay. So it's an awareness of outcomes that if you fall asleep, you know, or if you become complacent, you know, in some sense that is almost an unconscious feeding of patterns or providing the climate of mind for patterns to feed on where the outcomes are not so good. You know, so actually keeping that remembering and that sort of Dharma lens in mind is actually what inspires you. Yeah. Yeah, Ed.
I found that at various times the factor of interest that often gets fueled by an intuition. For example, I used to really dislike the Brahma-Vihara practice intensely. It was too woo-woo, too feely. And yet about 8 or 9 years into the practice, I had a strong intuition that it was exactly where I needed to go. And I felt drawn to it with interest.
Yeah.
And did it as my primary practice for about 2 years. And it was transformational and it just alive with that interest, energy.
Yeah. And there's something in there too that you're saying about learning, about an ongoing learning, that interest is leading to sort of an ongoing learning and stretching into places where you're not always comfortable. You know? And I think that is quite critical, you know, to have that ongoing learning and sometimes the places or the practices that are difficult for us to go to are the ones that we have something to learn from. Yeah.
There's just kind of a sense that having resources and needs met does not doesn't take away suffering.
No. Having the sense that having, I don't know if you can hear, but, so having the sense even when your needs are met, it actually doesn't, it's not a remedy for suffering. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
The
building or pauses and stillness, and I think that involves eliminating a lot of the busyness in life. I guess enunciation is not like a some place I didn't want to go. I think when I first heard the word, but I think because I understand it now, it seems to have so much more importance to the let go of what's not serving me.
Yeah.
Room for the things that really have more useful.
Yeah.
I don't know if these are the same thing on the other side of the coin, endurance and complacency. If they're really similar. And I usually don't go to complacency. I go to endurance, even though if we're talking about basic needs, I haven't met. And, when you're talking about the establishment of mindfulness, the establishment of being collective, like I do a lot of social justice, political work in coalitions, like Round Housing right now, which we have a disaster here in Seattle, right? And you're in a coalition, and there's all these people, and they're coming from all these different places, and there's all these dynamics going on. And it's one thing if I make enough time to do my practice in the morning to be collected in the morning, but an hour later when I'm in the meeting, I mean, how is it possible to stay collected? To stay
it is possible.
It is possible.
It is possible. It is possible, and these are the situations where it's most needed. Because that's what we contribute to those moments.
And it's the homework, or I don't know, I look at it as homework, maybe that's not a good view, but of what keeps me most centered, most mindful, most present, doing the homework of that. Then when I get in this situation, maybe I would stay more.
And that is, it is a curriculum or the homework, as you would call it, or an investigation, you know? What is it that really contributes to that collectedness and what detracts from it? And, you know, we can be in the most bizarre, wild situations, completely collected. And I absolutely have 100% confidence that this is possible. That this is indeed possible. And it contributes much to an agitated world. You know? When we really see the world does actually not need, even in the best causes and the best concerns and the best commitments, agitation is as likely as in the worst. You know? And the world simply doesn't benefit from agitation, and there's already so much, and how to actually calm that inwardly and actually find the way to actually bring that collectedness to those places of agitation. It is possible.
How do you develop the faith that it is possible to have that?
Well, you actually develop it through your own experience. You know, you develop. There isn't any other ground for that confidence except through your own experience, and your experience grows through your own development, you know, and your own cultivation, and that's what you can have confidence in. It is very practical. There's nothing metaphysical about this, and this is why, and we talked a lot about this yesterday, this is why it is a training. Is why it is a training. Yeah.
It seems that the complacency is getting in the way of insight. One of the best remedies is the practice of gratitude, speaking with the Buddha Mahamas, the continual investigation of what around us has brought us to this place of safety. Continual questioning of what would it be like without that? And the deep thanking that it's there.
Yeah. So one of the questions, around gratitude actually shattering complacency, you know, actually really having that sense of appreciation for what really we do have, however much or however little it is, to actually have that sense of gratitude. I mean, it's interesting in the text, you know, how much the Buddha uses this word ardency, You know, and when we think of the word ardency, we would often relate it to sort of relationship, you know, when we're very ardently in love. But it's actually referring to this sense of passion, you know. So he's actually not talking about sort of being on cruise control. He's actually having this sense of passion, enthusiasm, you know, zeal, he uses the word. But it's actually a joyful ardency, and that's the part to remember. It's not a sort of, you know, gritting my teeth, forcing. It's actually a joyful ardency. There's something very joyful about cultivating collectedness. You know, there's something very joyful about, you know, established mindfulness. You know, there's something very joyful, actually, in seeing difficulties falling away. You know, that so it's a joyful ardency. It's not like joy is going to be the reward for having suffered enough. You know, one actually needs to find not only gratitude but also joy in those efforts, because one is really appreciating that, you know, the beauty of those aspirations and those efforts. And yet that sits so alongside, you know, the bit of recognize, it's no wonder, you know, that he, you know, again, talk about cherry picking the Dharma, you know. You know, if you go to the Satipatthana and the mindfulness of the body, you know, how much of it is dedicated to symmetry contemplations, you know, and decomposition and charnel grounds. And it wasn't because the Buddha actually thought, you know, this was, let's go get everybody, you know, upset and depressed. You know? It was because he says, you know, if you actually really, really appreciate the fragile nature of your life, you would not waste a moment. You know? You would not waste a moment in waking up. So all of those contemplations were designed to sort of inspire that sense of passion and ardency, you know, that is actually rooted in appreciating, you know, the implications of impermanence, you know, that truly we don't have time to waste, you know, we don't have time to, you know, yeah, you know, when I'm retired, then I'll really get on the case, you know, and it's also, you know, it's also, I think, about this interest and curiosity that you're speaking about, the gratitude. It's about, we absolutely need to take this off the cushion. You know, this is often where our edges are already stretched. And this is actually needs to be our classroom and our practice ground, you know. And not to feel somehow, you know, that my 45 minutes or my half an hour, my cushion. We need to have that sense of curiosity in that classroom that you're talking about, you know. How do I, in the midst of this, in the middle of this, actually establish mindfulness, establish collectedness, see the patterns not activated and fall away, find those tastes of freedom? You know, because if it's not off the cushion as well as on, you know, it's not really a path, it's a practice, you know, it's a cushion practice.
I have always found gratitude to be a really important component in my practice, and I really appreciate what you said about the shadow of complacency. I hadn't put that together, but I think that's great. But in reading the suttas, I find, you know, reference to gratitude missing, and maybe I'm missing something, maybe you should think different words.
I think it's appreciative joy. I think it's more in the realm of appreciative joy. I think this is where, I mean, there is writing about gratitude, but I think it is more under the, it really is under the umbrella of appreciative joy. It's one of the aspects of mudita. Yeah, it's one of the aspects of mudita.
Along the same line of gratitude, I have found often that a tremendous appreciation for the artists in our midst. So when I hear a piece of music, or I've been moved to read a book, or I've seen something beauty that has been created from just a profound sense of gratitude that somebody is out there doing their work and expressing it, and it somehow shifts me back into myself again. And I guess it's not even into me, it's a release from myself. A release from self, and it kind of helps me along again to remind me what that was world shifts the perspective.
I mean, I find personally it very valuable, you know, to have, I think a lot of this training has quite a relationship to discipline, you know, and how discipline can be rooted in, you know, kind of really stoicism and self-beating up, or discipline can be really rooted in joy. But I think there's a very powerful link here between actually establishing all of this and the discipline that we bring inwardly. And remembering the etymology of the word discipline, it's to follow that which we love. To follow that which we love, which is a different framing of discipline than that how we usually hear it. To really follow that which we love. But I do think this discipline part is really because we are so easily forgetful. And we're just so easily forgetful in so many ways, you know, that if we don't... And what is it that sparks that interest? What is it that sparks that curiosity, that investigation, you know? And discipline is part of it, you know? I mean, if I look at my own, you know, sort of... If I look at my own meditative calendar, you know, in the annual calendar, you know, I will take 6 months where I do nothing but develop samatha. Collectedness, you know, I feel it's that important and that significant, you know, that the uncollected mind hasn't got a chance, quite frankly, you know. So, you know, I would give 6 months every year just to developing samatha, you know, over and above everything else, you know. And then I would give 3 months to insight practices and 3 months to Brahmavihara practices. But I would have that kind of discipline, you know. I don't turn up on a cushion and just see what happens. You know, I actually have personally, I find it very helpful to have a sense of aspiration, a sense of direction, a sense of intention that is sustained over a period of time for something to develop. So that kind of discipline, you know, requires some discipline, you know. It actually does. And, you know, many of you have heard me mention, you know, I sort of have an annual intention that I'm going to develop for a year. You know, and actually stay with it on a daily basis for a year at least. You know, like a few years ago, you've heard me say I gave up hurrying. You know, that was a renunciation for a year. It was magnificent. So I can still move quickly. I just don't hurry because that's such a state of mind. You know, but you know, it was such a relief. I've never been interested in taking it up again. Hurrying. This year, my commitment is to have no neutral people in my life. You know, and I find that awesome. I find it absolutely startling, you know, that commitment to have no neutral people in my life. No people who are just functions, you know. So, you know, the person who serves me in the supermarket, you know, the person at the gas station, the person I pass on the street, you know. The countless people that we just don't see because we have no personal story with them, you know, or history with them. And, you know, and just to have that commitment for years is eye-opening. It's eye-opening. But I think we require these kind of cues, you know, to keep that interest level very alive, but also to feel a little bit of a stretch. I mean, sometimes life is already providing that stretch, and we certainly don't need to be seeking it. But if we're in that comfort zone, I think the stretch comes from within rather than waiting for life to deliver the stretch when we're kind of unprepared for it. But that's actually also what really evokes that sense of curiosity and interest and enthusiasm. So I think we actually really need to examine, you know, what is it, you know, don't wait for the interest to arise. What will actually sort of bring that interest alive in us, you know? And how much are we actually really training these things, you know, the uncollected mind, the unestablished mindfulness, you know? I mean, that would be a wonderful intention for a year, wouldn't it? Collected mind. In all moments, you know? Cultivating that, you know, establishing that. This is how it comes into being, You know, not because we make periodic visits to collectedness, but because we commit to it. And so, Daniel.
I so often find that my own practice seems very ponderous, and I'm really drawn to the idea of play and experiment, the idea that this is an adventure.
And, yeah.
And so I'm not sure if it was in something that you taught a couple of years ago when you were here, but there was mention of a Burmese teacher who taught a practice of body scanning,
yeah,
using metta. May my crown be relaxed, so on. And that inspired me to just, once you have an understanding of some of these recipes, you can just see what's in the fridge and start cooking.
Yeah.
Without the recipes, or you can combine them and sort of be creative with them. I think that keeps me...
And that's important, and being aware of the kind of near enemy of that is being so overly creative that we're just trying to keep ourselves excited rather than interested.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
It can be entertaining.
Yes, yes, yeah. Yeah.
You could do somewhat similar by just, if you're complacent and everything's in your comfort zone, pick something that's outside your comfort zone.
Absolutely, pick something that's outside your comfort zone.
Since you gave us permission to talk about goals, just...
Goals, yes.
The idea of nibbana and that it's possible, maybe even in this lifetime, lights fire for me.
Good, good. Yeah, the possibility of nibbana in this lifetime lights fire for you. That's great. That's great. And, you know, you're totally on the page with what the Buddha taught, you know. You don't get any sort of procrastination from the Buddha's teaching. Just leave it, you know, another few lifetimes. It's not going to be you anyway, even if that's so, you know, so it would be completely meaningless for you. So actually, yeah, it's what the Buddha taught. He didn't teach something different. Yeah.
I think making friends with people who are in really different life situations than you are, getting to know them as sort of watching your own reactions and how you're different from them, how you like them, how you're feeling about how you're feeling.
Yeah.
I just really found that to be a big area of
exposing yourself to the unfamiliar rather than to always the places of agreement and similarity.
If you have everything you need and then you interact with people who don't, I think that can be, you know, the whole sense of the size of the community.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is,
yeah. Yeah. Indeed. Yes.
One thing that keeps me excited and to come back and reminds me is attending talks, picking up a book, things that just help me, remind me of what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And just set those goals.
Yeah.
Only out of one place.
Yeah.
One of our teachers, I think it was probably Rodney, gave us a homework once, and the one sentence in it was, "What would you do now if you were not afraid?" And so I cut that out and put that on my laptop screen. And that to me is just a trigger, because those things that I would do if I weren't afraid are something that I want in some way. It's a growth. And the fear is keeping me back from it. And so it's like every time I look at that, I can think of something that I would do if I weren't afraid. And it might be small or big, but it's right there for me immediately when I see that phrase.
Yeah.
And that can keep me from being complacent.
Yeah. What would I do if I wasn't afraid? Yeah. So let's have a foray into the third of these jungle thickets. So first of all, we've been talking about, you know, when you need to make changes, you know, when life is just too disorganized, too much of a struggle, or when you've got everything you need but nothing is changing inwardly. Now the third of these jungle thickets, a bhikkhu living in some jungle thicket, living there, unestablished mindfulness becomes established, unconcentrated mind becomes concentrated, undestroyed taints come to destruction, attains the unattained supreme security from bondage. Yet the requisites of life that are needed are hard to come by. So the bhikkhu should consider, here I am, I'm actually making progress, I'm actually establishing all these things. I remember that I didn't go forth from home life into homelessness for the sake of robes, alms, food, resting place, and medicine. Moreover, while I'm living here, my unestablished mindfulness has become established. Having reflected that thus, the bhikkhu should continue living in that jungle thicket. So this is kind of a different life scenario, isn't it? You know, life can be very difficult and very challenging. And, you know, we may very well feel that we don't have enough of what we need. You know, so we need to translate this into our life. You know, we may feel that, you know, conditions around us are really, really difficult. And, you know, we can be drawn to look outwardly to those who seem to have a better life than we have, you know, and be discontented, feeling that, you know, if I had better conditions, you know, if I had a better neighborhood, a better relationship, if I had more money, if I had more security, then surely I would progress on the path. And I think it's this sense that life really doesn't need to be perfect for us to deepen in awareness. And our life doesn't need to be perfect for us to actually bring to fruition many of the qualities that we really value and aspire to. Life certainly doesn't need to be perfect for us to cultivate inner collectedness, insight, and freedom. I think believing that our happiness is dependent on perfection and our life conditions is really to volunteer for a life of busyness and agitation. And we see how much time we spend with this, don't we? You know, just the big and the little gestures of rearranging conditions, you know, so I'm a little warmer, I'm a little cooler, you know, or I'm, you know, my chair's a little bit more comfortable, or I found that right cushion, you know, or, you know, I've just rearranged the furniture in my house for the 50th time, you know, and no, I just really need that one thing, you know, and then I'm really going to stop needing, you know, how much time and energy is this ongoing arrangement of the world of conditions, imagining that there is some point of perfection, and we give that all up, and we actually see how much agitation is tied into this. So much busyness and agitation tied into this. I mean, life makes many demands on many, many people, you know, in terms of time, in terms of energy, but our minds make way more demands upon us in terms of busyness and agitation, you know, and the exhaustion that that brings. A lot of that is about maximizing pleasure and minimizing pain. It's a kind of bottom line, you know. How much can I maximize the pleasure? How much can I minimize the pain? And how that ties us always to leaning forward into a better, more perfect moment when we're going to be calm, when we're going to be mindful. This I call postponement practice. We postpone and we postpone and we postpone, you know, until that one more adjustment is made. It's an easy, you know, there's a certain encouragement outwardly, actually quite a lot of encouragement from the world to engage in this busyness. And the only place there's a wonderful Tibetan saying, you know, it says, preoccupations do not come to an end until the moment we die. They end when we put them down. They end when we put them down. And I think, you know, when we value collectedness and seek for collectedness, in the same time we really need to be so clear and so honest about where we're engendering busyness inwardly. Mm-hmm. Just to keep ourselves moving. Just to keep ourselves moving. It's called postponement practice, and it also externalizes happiness and freedom. And I think for many people it's a real challenge to be aware of how chronic restlessness has become in their lives. How chronic restlessness has become in their lives. Seeking for that perfect, you know, that perfect moment to be free in. Yeah. So we should, it is not perfect and we should stay. It is not perfect and we learn to actually embrace imperfection. Thoughts? How willing you are to embrace imperfection? Yeah. Gratitude again is important, yeah.
I guess I think of the three basics, because I can get really trapped in conceit, like something I've done is just great or it was just terrible, those opposites. And if I go back to, I had to correct it, there is no separate self, because I have to do the antidote to the conceit. To be able to be okay with the moment, what's gone on. I kind of got the lunge in there, a little confused.
Okay.
He just brought up a really sweet memory that I had of this teacher that I had a long time ago, Ruth Dennison. And Ruth Dennison, she was a Vipassana teacher.
Yeah.
She would bring her dogs up.
Yeah.
And I thought she would talk about the imperfections and how that would to sit through those. And so she would do the mindfulness of the body practices. I would just be talking on her. And so she would share my gratitude.
Yeah. It should just reflecting on, again, coming back to gratitude and actually, you know, how, you know, learning to embrace imperfection is actually probably one of the biggest pathways in our lives. And without it, you know, the alternative is to be just constantly tinkering with the world of conditions. And this is where the Buddha's saying, you know, you actually have what you don't, everything's not perfect, but look, your mindfulness is established in the midst of that. You know, your collectedness is established in the midst of that.
I was just going to say that sometimes I think just having humor about it can really lighten up the sense that everything needs to be perfect.
Humor is an indispensable ally on this path. Yes. I think it's so.
So, of course, my world kind of got flipped upside down a month ago. And one day, the thought came to me that every single death leaves a hole in somebody's heart.
Yeah.
And so that sense of, sure, it happened to me, but there's this kind of bigger connection with all of life happens this way.
Yeah.
And I just took that aging, illness, and death into a kind of reality.
Absolutely. Yep.
And there was kind of a strength that I felt.
personal and it's universal. It's both. It's both of those. You know, it's not one or the other, but again, it is so easily one of the, you know, it's why the Buddha so much encouraged the contemplation of aging, sickness and death, you know, because it's one of those ones that, you know, we're pretty sure it happens to other people until it happens to us. And then suddenly there is that wake-up call, you know, truly a wake-up call, and that can actually be quite enlightening. And actually, as you say, knowing the universality doesn't make the personal less painful, but it makes it less free from argument. It makes it more free from argument. Makes it more free from argument, I think. Yeah. I mean, I remember, you know, someone living with chronic illness saying to me, you know, that going through life for so many years, you know, with feeling the unfairness of it all, and saying, why has this happened to me? And the moment she could say, why would this not happen to me? Is the moment she said, really, her healing began. So I think it's time we have a stretch or something to wake up. Don't know if anybody's asleep, but to wake up. I think it's important that we keep in mind the context of these discourses that we've been talking about over the last couple of days, that they all share this kind of parallel theme of, you know, how do we turn this mind that can feel so unruly and uncooperative and untrained into this mind, this way of being in the world where there's an established collectedness, an established gatheredness, where there's a dropping away of that which really obstructs freedom, leads away from freedom. But there's an establishing of this understanding of awakening. And this is really, when the Buddha speaks about a mind that is a friend, truly a friend, he is really speaking about this kind of mind, but recognizing all the time that the mind is not invulnerable to the world of conditions, that it's always a relationship. Some of that we need to take care of very carefully. Some of that is we cannot change. Some of it is simply there. And some of it we choose in a way. In a way we choose. So it's always looking at this interrelationship between the inner and the outer and the inner. This is constantly the theme of the Buddha's teaching, that the classroom of awakening really is in the middle of all things, you know, and that was really what made him a radical in his time, of not trying to transcend the world, not trying to, you know, transcend the body or the mind, but actually to transform that body and mind, and therein to actually transform the world. We come to the fourth of these jungle thickets. And, you know, we've kind of worked up from the really bad news to the really good news, you know, that the first jungle thicket where nothing works inwardly or outwardly, you know, to this actually fourth of the jungle thickets. It says here a bhikkhu lives in some jungle thicket, is still in the world, notice, you know, still in the middle of it all, lives in some jungle thicket. And living there, unestablished mindfulness becomes established. Unconcentrated mind becomes concentrated. Undestroyed taints come to destruction, and they attain the unattained supreme security from bondage. And also the requisites of life that are needed are easy to come by. The bhikkhu should consider thus, I'm living in this jungle thicket, and all of this has come to be. And that bhikkhu should continue in that jungle thicket as long as life lasts. They should never depart. This is where I think there is that final surrender of the arguments with the unarguables. You know, it's actually not saying life is perfect. The jungle thicket is still there. you know, there is still confusion. There is still a chaotic world. There are still uncooperative conditions. So the jungle thicket hasn't changed at all. What has changed, of course, is the way the mind is abiding. And this is where we don't take it for granted. We realize we really do have the optimal conditions outwardly to thrive, deepen, discover unshakable freedom, and the optimal conditions inwardly. And this is where the mind is really set upon awakening. But then the discourse goes on to really talk about dependency, you know, that we live dependent upon a village, a town, a city, a country. We live dependent upon a person. And here too, in this kind of very, very relational sense, we examine this quality or this state of dependency. And again, the Buddha's not saying that dependency is always wrong. He's actually saying, you know, it is a fact, actually. We are dependent human beings. So he's not always saying that dependency is wrong. We are dependent on everything, as Martin Luther King says. You know, we live eternally in the red. You know, before we even leave our house in the morning, we're already indebted to half of the world. You know, for the soap we use, the coffee we drink, you know, the clothes we wear, the food we eat, that we live eternally in the red, indebted to half the world. So recognizing that dependency is simply part of being alive, you know, and being supported, just as others depend upon us. So there's that layer of dependency which actually speaks about just our the way that we cannot break our link with the world of conditions. You know? We cannot break our link to the world of conditions. So there's that level of dependency that the Buddha is speaking about. And then he's talking, and we can thrive in that. In the midst of that dependency, we can establish mindfulness, establish a concentrated mind, see things fall away, you know, attain liberation. And there's another way of dependency where actually we don't. Where we are not collected, where we are not mindful, where mindfulness is not established, you know. So it's actually looking at these two dimensions of dependency, that one is a simple reality and one is a reality of fear. One is a reality of fear. And that level of dependency is the one in which we do not thrive, in which might, because the mind cannot settle in the midst of fear. You know, the mind doesn't become concentrated in the midst of anxiety. You know, things certainly don't drop away as long as fear is a kind of governing principle in our life. And being aware that fear, certainly in Buddhist psychology, is one of the strands of ill will. One of the strands of aversion. But we don't thrive within that fear. And often our solution, our way of solving what we see as the problem of fear and anxiety, is dependency on another level. And this is actually the level of identification, where we lean. We lean upon many things in our life. I mean, the sutta describes, you know, dependency on a city, a town, or a village, or a person, where mindfulness doesn't become established. But what we depend upon, of course, is essentially what we are identified with. And what we are identified with, we are tied to. And in that being tied to, there is a denial of freedom. What we are tied to, we are also defined by. So here the Buddha is really speaking to this world of self-building, and how the world of self-building is a world that is built upon what we lean upon, identify with, and are defined by. And in here he is saying, you know, all of these wonderful things don't happen. Mindfulness doesn't become established. You know, the mind is not collected. Things don't fall away, and certainly there is an absence of freedom. And I think one of the kind of central investigations that we are really asked to undertake as practitioners is actually really to understand this world, this fabricated world of self-building and world-building. You know, the Buddha said, he was deeply interested in the architecture of suffering, how suffering comes into being, recognizing that suffering and struggle are not predetermined, that they're not life sentences, that suffering and struggle is something that is created and recreated through confusion and through distortion. And he says, if we're going to understand the architecture of suffering, we also need to understand the architecture of how our personal world of experience is being built, and how in the middle of that personal world of experience is the selfing that is identified with. The selfing that is identified with. This shapes our world. This shapes our world. So as practitioners, I think, you know, one of our invitations is really to look very carefully and very honestly at what it is that we lean upon for a sense of me and a sense of I am. Sometimes we don't even know that we lean upon things until actually we lose them, or they're threatened, or they're challenged in some way, you know. But we can lean upon so many things, can't we? Our roles, our gender, our nationality, our politics, our credential, our bodies, our opinions. And all of this is how we endeavor to build safety. This is how we endeavor to build security and reliability and stability. It's through that mechanism of identification, through actually proclaiming and reproclaiming many times in a single day, the I am, you know, the I am, the I have, that I need, that I become. So the Buddha says, you know, if we're actually going to find this, you know, unassailable, this unshakable freedom from bondage, it is contingent upon actually that investigation into dependency and into an identification to see if this is a dependency in life in which we're thriving and mindfulness is established, or if this is a dependency which is actually there to safeguard us feeling fear. Safeguard us from feeling fear. What do we rely upon for safety and security? What do we rely upon for safety and security? Because it's also just so critical in this whole understanding of suffering and the end of suffering to really acknowledge that as long as we are self-building, we are simultaneously other-building. Because the self only exists in relationship to the other. The bigger the self, the bigger the other. So, this dependency inwardly is almost automatically creating opponents in the other. You know, those who actually don't share the same opinions, you know, the same orientations, the same views, the same... Even then, they still remain somewhat the other, just a less dangerous other, a more agreeable other. But I think this is really critical to this entire path to examine this. I mean, the Buddha doesn't sort of, you know, even as you read in the Satipatthana, you know, the refrain that says, you know, learning to abide independent, not clinging to anything in this world. The kind of independence he's speaking about is not about a disconnection or a dissociation or a cutting off. He's actually bringing about this end of leaning upon for a sense of I am. For a sense of I am. I think probably our true challenge is actually to embrace our dependency without identification. That is probably our greatest and our true challenge, to embrace our dependency without identification. without craving, without self-building, without setting in place the clinging that will lead to suffering. In the Satipatthana, the refrain actually goes, abiding independent, not governed by anything in this world. Not governed by. Any thoughts? It's about what we cannot feel we cannot do without. I mean, that's the sort of core. And, you know, what does that look like, to embrace dependency without identification? I mean, I think that is the core. First of all, remembering that certainly in Buddhist psychology, identification is simply a continuum of craving and aversion. It's not something separate. That's very important to understand, you know, that clinging or identification is not some sort of separate psychological, emotional movement apart from craving and aversion. It's simply an intensification, you know. It's moving from the, you know, oh, I kind of like this, you know, oh, yeah, I really want this, to I really need this, to this, I won't survive without this. So, you know, it's simply that intensification to, you know, from something, this is kind of unpleasant, you know, oh, no, I really don't like this, I really hate this, you know, I really need this to go away, and if this doesn't go away, you know, I will dissolve, you know. So it's simply that continuum, which is really important. So if we look at what dependency looks like without identification, I think we'd have to look a little bit before the identification or the self-building actually forms, perhaps to those movements of craving and aversion that we actually consent to, feed, reinforce, until they magnify and solidify into an I am. So what does it mean to live in this world, you know, of conditions which are so variable, so changeable, the lovely, the unlovely, the supportive, the unsupportive? You know, what does it mean to actually live in that relationship, which is a dependent relationship, without the added extras of craving and aversion? You know, and there's many ways that the Buddha speaks about bringing craving and aversion to a cessation. You know, it's not just one way. You know, craving has origins. You know, craving has origins in, you know, inner culture of deficit and lack and insufficiency, you know, in discontent. Craving has origins in discontent. You know, so what do we do about discontent? You know, we can either use craving as a mechanism to problem solve, or actually we can cultivate inner contentment. Craving has origins in, you know, sort of diminished sense of self. How do we attend to that? Maybe we're cultivating some of those treasures that I talked about yesterday, you know, ethics and confidence and, dignity and metta and compassion. You know, maybe we find that's our answer to insufficiency rather than craving, you know. What do we do with ill will? You know, aversion, you know, We much of what our practice is about is developing our capacity to stand in the middle of aversion without being governed, you know, to develop, you know, equanimity, to develop confidence, to develop resilience, to develop balance and poise. So I think to sort of go for undoing identification is probably not the best way, because, you know, that's, you know, who's going for it, you know, who's letting go, you know, who's working on it, you know, who's trying to undo the identification, rather than seeing identification is actually also born of a set of conditions, you know, and perhaps we backtrack a little bit from the identification to the sense of I need and I can't bear, you know, or I must have or I can't accommodate. Those particular movements of craving and aversion, which quite frankly are much more approachable, you know, because if we can actually approach those movements, it's stopping that momentum of intensification from building up. You know, because if you took into your practice, you know, the question of, you know, I'm going to be really mindful and undo identification, it's kind of like you sit there puzzled, don't you? How do I do that? You know, how would I possibly do that? But actually, to backtrack a little bit, to actually see how that is born, and that in places that are much more approachable. So then we can have, you know, we actually do live in that dependency. But without that movement towards or away from, or, you know, the, we don't forget about impermanence, you know, we don't forget about embracing that which is unarguable. And that's where I think we begin to actually really, really take the bedrock away from the I am building and the identification building. That would be my sense of it.
A little bit confused, but you're talking about two types of dependence.
Yes.
So the one that you're reflecting on, you see, then I'm thinking of dependent origination, that philosophy, that understanding of dependent origination. Is that the second type of
this is world building, yes. Paticca Samuppada, or dependent origination, really speaks to the way our world is being constructed moment to moment. And actually you see, and Paticca Samuppada is more than a philosophy, actually. This is the content of the Buddha's awakening. You know, this is actually what he saw under the Bodhi tree. So, and actually you see in that dependent arising, dependent origination, that process, you know, the very significant link between feeling tone and the arising of craving and aversion, and how that actually turns into clinging, turns into becoming the I am. You know, that's clearly traced out in dependent arising. And actually, you know, you can step off that wheel, of course, at any point, in any moment. And the weakest point in that whole wheel is this link between feeling tone and craving and aversion. Hmm? Yeah.
Would it make sense to think of somebody as embracing the interdependence, the more the connection with other people, rather than intensifying, carving out this separate identity?
Well, I think the fact of dependency is just something we need to acknowledge. You know, it's just simply there. None of us are independent beings, you know. I think it's simply a fact, and it's a fact that's revealed every day, you know, every moment of our lives, you know. And what the Buddha is saying, you know, that this is not a problem. You know, you thrive in that. You can establish mindfulness in that, you know. So he's really speaking about, you know, the jungle thicket has not gone away. The jungle thicket is still there. He's talking about much more the psychological, emotional dependency that is built on top of that. Yeah.
I'm very struck by your use of the word embrace. Because you could say something like recognize our dependence. But you chose to use word embrace, which to me conveys a softness that doesn't come across with the word recognize. And it implies something to me of, I'm going to use the word love, but I don't mean it in a conventional way.
Yeah.
It conveys a universality of caring and love.
think that's true. I mean, I think the recognition of our dependency is quite humbling, particularly when we live in a culture, you know, where there's so much, you know, virtue attached to independence, you know, as a sort of state, and independence is usually defined by having built an unassailable self. You know, that's the illusion of independence, is I've established an unassailable self that's somehow not touched by the life or not dependent upon so many factors for every single breath I take, you know. So there is something quite humbling, I think, about recognize, you know, about connecting with that sense of dependency, you know, and it takes away that sense of unassailability, which was never true in the first place, which was only, you know, the unassailable self is simply the self that is built upon powerful movements of identification, you know. So there is something humbling, and it does place us in the family of all beings.
I'm reminded that the origin of the word humility is humus, which is the decay of the physical. That we are of the earth.
I mean, I think it is deeply unfortunate in our culture, you know, that from a very young age we're encouraged to pursue that unassailable self, you know, which has much to do with, you know, Westerners' issues with self-judgment and self-blame and feelings of failure and unworthiness, you know, because we imagine somewhere out there somebody's built that unassailable self, but they're actually just better at looking that way. You know, and they're still dependent, you know, and they will still age and sicken and die, and they will still experience losses. And, you know, and yet somehow the inflation of that as a sort of a worthy pursuit, I think, makes it very hard to establish mindfulness or concentration or collectedness or, you know, liberation, because it is a fearful place, you know. Inhabiting a world, constructed world of self, essentially is a fearful, agitated place. And I think the Buddha saw this very clearly, which is why he didn't teach annihilation of self, where he actually taught seeing the emptiness of these fabrications and these constructions as a means to the deepest happiness, you know? Not as a means of somehow debasing ourselves or, you know, eliminating ourselves, but as a means to the deepest happiness, you know. And self-building is such a somatic experience, isn't it? I mean, we don't notice it until we come across a self that looks, you know, is not quite the same as ourself, you know. You know, somebody disagrees with our opinions, you know, or, you know, has a different political view. And then you feel that clench, you know, the clench of the heart, you know, and identification is actually clenching, you know. It's living in an ongoing state of being clenched. Always a little bit sort of defensive, a little bit on guard, you know. And so the Buddha is actually using this kind of sense of unclenching, you know, as a path to the sort of, as a path not to danger or a lack of safety, but the supreme safety from bondage. I mean, it's so interesting that the term he uses in this over and over again, the supreme security from bondage. The supreme security from being tied or being imprisoned. Dependency without identification.
Right. So something that's been going through my mind a little bit is one interesting area to potentially explore the idea would be even parenting, because it's sort of one of, for a lot of people, it's one of the more fundamental dependent relationships, which is, I mean, a good thing, obviously.
Yeah.
But trying to figure out what that would look like sort of see that some of the some pretty bad things can happen when you have that dependency with really strong identity. I don't know if that's exactly.
Well, that's a classic example of where dependency with identification can actually go so badly wrong, you know, and many people have experienced it in their own lives with their own parents, you know, and determined not to repeat the pattern and find themselves repeating the pattern, thinking, well, you know, it's really important right now, but actually, am I just repeating the pattern, you know? And yet, it's such a wonderful example of how to play with that pairing, you know, of recognizing the very, very necessary, you know, very evident dependency. And yet where does the craving and aversion start to come in? You know, with a newborn it's hardly there, you know. But actually when the self starts building, you know, not quite the same as yourself, you know, as when the craving and aversion come, oh, that's really sweet, then that's really, you know, really not sweet. You know, it's how the craving and aversion comes in, and that those most loving relationships. You know, so craving and aversion don't require, you know, a difficult relationship. Actually, probably these are the most tender areas of our lives where we endeavor to have loving relationships with other people. And knowing the dependency and the loveliness of that, but also seeing what identification does to it.
So it's kind of interesting to me to try to think about how you be a parent or a child or whatever without that.
How are you a parent or a child or a partner? Without that identification.
Because I'm not exactly sure.
Well, it is truly. I mean, but you can't imagine how it looks. I mean, you have to sort of play with it, don't you? You have to bring it exactly into that relationship, you know, and actually see. Well, you know, where does conflict arise? Okay, that's a good clue. You know, probably that's where the identification, the self-building, is happening, on the basis of craving or aversion. Where does conflict not arise? Okay, that's where the dependency is there, but not the identification. So, I mean, that's a really good, you know, exploration or way in, you know. Is conflict pointing to some, not dependency, but to some identification that has been built on craving and aversion that is creating a self and another? So that's probably really a useful way in, and actually looking when that conflict is not there. You know, and what is you know, also what is absent from those spaces where there's no conflict. So I think that's probably a really, really good way in. Yeah. Actually, you know, when you say what does that look like, or hard to imagine what that looks like, you probably already have tastes of what that looks like. You know, you probably already have many tastes of what that looks like. You know, and I think the great genius of the Buddha was actually to build upon what we already know or have already tasted. You know, rather than building upon that which undermines.
Yes, and I was thinking about a grown son who has not been in touch, and someone commented, well, he's not doing what you want him to. And I think the identity is that I'm okay. I'm not okay if he doesn't get in touch with me. I have a dependence on his behavior in terms of responding. And then I just thought it was interesting.
He said,
well, he's not doing what you want him to.
Yeah.
A neutral statement.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just simply a statement of fact. You know, he's not doing what I want him to. Or it could be a really explosive statement.
But it was a neutral statement.
Yeah. think when the Satipatthana speaks about not being governed, not being defined, not leaning, I think another way in for us is very much to start to listen out for the words inwardly of I need or I want. You know, the Buddha very much speaks about craving and aversion as compulsions. You know, they're not like I choose. You know, it's not like I'm choosing to be aversive. Sometimes we may. But he speaks about them much more as compulsions. And you know, the piece about, you know, the teaching on impermanence is really important for this. You know, that nothing is going to stand still for us, no matter whether we love it or hate it. You know, it's not going to stand still for us. And so I think this whole discourse is about really learning and beginning to discover truly what it means to live in the midst of the jungle thickets, you know, in the midst of all things, with mindfulness, with collectedness, with insight and a growing sense of freedom and a recognition that these are not accidents or not reserved for special people. These are conscious cultivations. These are intentional cultivations, you know. And without that intention to engage with those cultivations, we're not on the path of liberation. And that's what we're asked to engage with in the midst of the thicket. So I think we've done what needs to be done here. That's how I'm going to put it. We've done what needs to be done. So maybe just have a stand for 2 minutes and then we'll end with just a short sit. I'd just like to say a very big thank you to everyone who's managed and volunteered over the weekend, and a very big thank you to all of you for your attention and your listening over many hours of listening, which I know is quite demanding. So thank you very much for coming.